I don't believe that any of the studies that the brain people are doing right now are transferable. And there's no interpretations that find meaning for everything. And I think you can read them and you can get inspiration from them. So I'm not saying don't ever read any of this stuff, but you need to process it for the self-discovery of any system you're looking at. And people always say, well, make it your own. Well, nope, because usually you haven't even questioned what the underpinnings were. And so you don't make it your own. You just kind of move it around a little and don't customize it for you. I'm saying don't try and customize. Go back and start with questioning.
Welcome to Business Second Opinion. This is the podcast that digs deep to answer hidden questions about business and business practice that you may not know you need to be asking. We focus on how to discern whether advice and recommended practice is going to be good for you. Too much is accepted without rigorous examination these days, but who has the time to do that research? Well, it turns out that we do. We do that rigorous digging for you, tell you what to be discerning about, and give you a second opinion on ideas that are offered as best practices. And to be fair, it's most often a contrarian opinion. We want to educate people on how to test and decide if offered truths will give you the outcomes you really want without the side effects they often include. I'm Zach Swartout, and with me as always is Carol Sanford, our in-house positive contrarian, responding to big and hard questions with a radically different take.
Hi, Zach.
Hi, Carol. So this is part two on paradigms of research that we began in episode 118. Here's a little bit of a recap for everybody around the previous podcast and with the preceding worldviews, of course. So Carol, will you take over from here and give us a little bit more background?
Sure. And I'm sure people would be happy to do that because the first time people told me after I went through it, there was a very dense conversation. And I agree. So we're going to pick up here. We had done three of the worldviews. Let me just do a quick overview on that. We talked about one of the earliest worldviews, and people know where this came from, is the royalty worldview. And that sometimes was the church, sometimes it was the state. And it was always based on the idea that the people who were in it were born to rule. Or they could lead because they had a family of certain kind of intelligences, and so therefore they deserved it. The machine worldview is a lot out of the Industrial Revolution, and or both of them, and it's based on the belief that humans are like machines. When machines were so successful and productive, people metaphorically immediately started making us like machines. But they added also the idea, like a machine, that you have to import energy into it. It can't do something for itself. And you have to create structures that support it being able to function like a machine. That went on for a few hundred years, and I shouldn't say went on. It should be goes on, because it still continues. But emerging in the early 20th century came the behavioral worldview, where studies were done using rats, and it's called behavioral, right? The behavioral psychology, behavioral worldview. And it was based on the idea that only thing you could study, and you could see this even sort of coming forward from machines, the only thing you can study is that which you can see, which you can observe, which you can use the senses to pick up. And it discounted any idea that there was an independent mind that was able to be at work.
Okay, great. So that's the first three worldviews that we covered. So now let's take on and tackle these last two. So tell us their era and how we can detect if the practices offered have moved away from the lower three and up to more kind of self-governing and living systems.
Sure. So the one that came in right after the behavioral theory and study of rats was pretty much a reaction to that behavioral view, because the behavioral view said people can't do anything. You can't study an intrinsic and internal thinking process, you know, and of course you can't from studying rats, but you could with humans. And that was the point here. You will know probably from working with some practices which were really designed to be what you might call a self-governing worldview or a human potential worldview, as you said earlier. And here you're speaking about people being self-directed, be able to be self-reporting on what they're experiencing in their own inner thoughts and processing. They're able to gain mastery of their own personal capabilities. And they're likely to be pursuing or referring to ideas like self-actualizing. The foundational ideas here about humans are that they are individuals which cannot be aggregated into averages. Although once in a while, humanists do that with personality typing. So they're mixing up a little bit different paradigms, as people are wont to do. But there was a guy named Todd Rose, who we've talked about here before, that wrote a book called End of Average, which through their studies proved that there really is no such thing as one or a set of types of people. But people have always loved them, even if they're not accurate, because they gave people something to reference, something to hang on to have these little categories of things. And I have a paper about that. If anybody's interested, you know how to reach me at carol@carolsanford.com. The methods that self-governing tended to use were interviews, surveys, and then they still beginning to aggregate them all together. So how in the world do you get to a truth about something's being touted scientifically and find out if it's really based on this worldview? Well, you look for these case studies, you look for surveys, interviews, where they're aggregating people, which Todd Rose told us in End of Average that aggregating doesn't leave you with any real understanding of the people who are involved. Most humanists still seem to fall back on promoting best practices. So you'll still hear that kind of languaging, averaging ideas, using case studies, testimonials. But the real shift the humanists were seeking to bring about was the rejection of external management of humans. You know, somebody from outside, like the behavioral study. The idea is that human could be self-directed and were able to accurately see their own thoughts, report them, take actions, and they could do that without feedback or guidance from others. So they would be self-motivating, self-managing of their own motivation.
So when I think of humanist psychology, I think of Maslow's hierarchy or even the work of Carl Rogers. That seems to be a set of ideas that's really about how people can reach their peak, right? Humans as individuals. So this is really about being able to contribute and grow and develop themselves to realize more potential. And it's really about life is pretty open-ended in terms of opportunity and possibilities. But what I'm really curious about is why they are even a worldview. Like, what else gets added here to our understanding of humans through this view?
Well, I agree with you with the source of that, Maslow, Carl Rogers, many other amazing people. This was in the 60s. What really got added here is the ability to see the break of overcoming behavioralism and see individuals as not being externally determined. That was the big articulation. They were focused on really waging a battle to carve out this psychological space. Now, I think in that process, the humanistic psychology got a little myopic, kind of narrowing down. They created an association, the American Humanistic Institute, and founded several universities actually on the West Coast. It attracted so many people who were put off, and I think I would say legitimately so, by the behavioral paradigm. What they took on was overcoming this worldview being the behavioral worldview, that the interesting thing is, it was simultaneously, while the humanists were bringing this new idea, behavioralism was taking over parenting, and it was taking over education. It was taking over most companies, where the humanistic psychology and this particular worldview was saying, no, you know, this is not human-centered. It's not ethical in the way you're positioning human beings. Its real downside, and the myopic part I'm talking about, is the humanist movement never really included non-human beings or ecological questions. There was a parallel movement, which we might just mention here. It's related to what the humanists were doing, but it was a myopic environmental view, where the environmentalist, we will call them, out of genuine concern, just like the humanists had a genuine concern, we're worried about the planet and all the considerations. And they went so far, and this is the myopic part, they went so far as to suggest that the planet would go on and be better off without humans. And that drops out what we're going to call the next level up, the living systems view. Should I jump into the living systems view?
Yeah, go for it.
So I think what gets added here, I liked your question about what gets added. I think the living systems view says humans, they're embedded in living systems with a core role to play that's actually critical to the evolution of Earth's own ability to live out its potential, not just for it to be preserved and survive. We are a system, and humans are part of that system. So the language to this nature of examination picks up different word choices and different research methods. It looks at humans in systems terms. So you hear systems thinking schools, however many of them, the early systems thinking schools who were trying to do this work were really still based on machine theory. So the systems dynamics concept, and others in the human potential movement, they applied it to systems and looked at family systems. But real living systems speak to the nested and embedded place of humans, animals, soil, biota, and all living beings into a system that is only able to be understood based on specific place and to be evolving over time.
So I'm following. That generally sounds good, but I don't quite understand how it applies to or works with research. Isn't research about looking at a bunch of different things and kind of seeing how they all fit together?
So the way you do it when you're doing a living systems kind of research is you're starting with a singularly undivided whole, and you're studying it using a framework for understanding. It's not about figuring out how to scale it or extrapolate truths from one entity to another, but for each system to stand as a whole system, be examined and engaged for itself. So I was talking about with a friend of mine, acupuncturist, how that's really the major war between allopathic medicine and naturopathic medicine or alternative Eastern medicines is the alternatives all believe it's one individual at a time. And allopathic medicine is looking for how it goes across everything. So in this case, it would be something like each child, each system as a whole system has to be examined and engaged, each family, each community, each valley, you know, if you're talking about somewhere on a river, each watershed, each organization, they are not ever aggregated to try and figure out what's average and best for all. In fact, you will hear language, and whether they use these words or not, you'll hear them examining something for the essence of that one entity. What makes it itself? You know, how does it process itself in a system? You know, and it'll always kind of show up the same way. And what purpose does it seem to serve? It has its own specific who it is.
So people at home can't see this, but my skeptical eyebrow is raised right now. So what you're telling me is there are not only no averages, but there's no isolated variables or teaching case stories that are kind of sourced from these other worldviews?
That's what I'm telling you.
Okay. All right. Well, keep going. Tell me a little bit more here.
So the interpretive methods that are used here are not seeking to get to best practices, which is what most of the averages kind of thing did. And all it had to do was have a statistically significant, which could be 2% over some other, and it would be named as the best thing for everybody who was involved, even if it was irrelevant for the system that was being studied. And even if it didn't actually increase any specific entity it was applied to. So every system in the living systems view has to stand alone and be understood alone. There are no methods that tend to provide you a knowledge base out of which you're seeking to publish or promote it. But instead, they are really trying to have the thoughts and the way of studying it on a singular level and supporting to understanding how you would evolve it, how you would actualize that system and reveal it out of some exploratory dialogue or engagement. Stories may be told, but the idea is not to have them be copied. And it might suggest paths, but the path you would have to know is only for that one singular system. So there are no best practices that can be transferred since the next system will be another one of one. There's no comparison, there are no averages, there are no calculations, no variables, and no thoughts of scaling. I know that drives you nuts, Zach.
I'd like to take a moment to thank our sponsors, who are working to examine their own worldviews and how it affects their way of thinking with management and even strategy. They also have one of our favorite deep business ideas, using ancient wisdom coupled with modern innovation to give vitalizing beverages you can be proud of. Their rallying cry is, "We are Rebel, a band of revolutionaries for the greater good." They are modern day botanical treasure hunters grounded in ancient herbal wisdom, identifying and gathering the very best of the plant queendom has to offer.
You know, just thinking about Rebel and the way they build their beverages, that they're really looking at many different ways that people can be healthy. And I know they're exploring the world in this way, so I'm so proud to have them be a sponsor for what we're doing. But let's get back to this. So let's take some real life examples that claim that they're drawing on scientific research, particularly the neuroscience field, which has gotten terribly popular. You'll see articles everywhere saying, make sure you're designing to work with the brain. And the way they're doing that is they're using what are called fMRIs, functional magnetic resonating images. And it means that you can see it. So you can study it. You can see it or in some cases hear things. But the worldview is really based on the idea of scientific research. Do you have any reflections on that?
Yeah, as I was listening to what you were saying, it sounds a lot like the machine worldview, right? So if I think back to the last episode, we talked quite a bit about how the machine worldview ends up with a strong focus on parting and piecing. It sounds like this fMRI neuroscience research is preoccupied really with mapping activity and blood flow into different regions of the brain. And then the conclusions drawn from this research seem to continually seek to explain this part of the brain is responsible for this activity or this behavior or this kind of thing. It seeks ultimately to map the brain and in so doing, divide it, categorize its parts, and then determine that those parts are responsible for a particular function. Does that sound about right?
Yeah, I think that's true. And I do think a lot of it is really machine view. I think the behavioral view got layered on top of that, which when John Watson developed the whole idea of behavioral science and research, he said, you can't study anything an objective observer cannot see or hear, that you can never trust the people to report for themselves. And so this particular, the neuroscience, is really operating off that same assumption. You don't ask people what's going on inside your head because they don't believe you can know. So yeah, I'm with you. I would just say behavioralism on top of it.
Okay, got it. So Carol, is this research that you're about to share with us, is that coming from the same worldview?
Yes. What I want to offer you is a couple of articles. We'll start with one, but are both written by David Rock, who's a brilliant guy. And he's the founder of Neural Leadership Institute. The first one is from the Harvard Business Review of February 22nd, 2018. So a little experiment here. I'd like for you to listen to the title of the article and then tell me what you notice. So the title is, Tell Employees What You Want Them to Strive For in As Few Words as Possible. So what do you see there?
Yeah, just the title, as you're kind of saying here, exposes quite a bit. So I think maybe as we were just talking about, I noticed that the paradigm that's implied here is basically that people need their behavior externally determined. Right? They need externally determined goals. And this again calls back to the machine paradigm that Frederick Winslow popularized. But humans are machines and therefore need external input or feedback from managers in order to determine their behavior. Does that sound about right?
Yeah, that's true. I would say it extends to not only importing, you know, the machine view, but it also feels like it needs somebody else to tell you what to do about it. So the machine view is that you have to import things in. As you said, it's externally determined. And of course, you can tell here because the word employees, tell employees, is a very hierarchical view, which we're now back to the royalty basis. And then what you want them to strive for assumes that they could not figure out, based on the context of where the business is going, where it should go, and it needs a few folks to help you. And the last one, in as few words as possible, means we have to dumb it down because they're not really smart, which comes out of the behavioral study of rats. So it's like everything in that title tells us that it is based on royalty, on machine worldview, and on behavioralism.
Yeah, I remember thinking back to one of the more famous quotes that Frederick Winslow Taylor said, which is that the only place you really need to pay attention to is whatever the man above you says. And so I think this speaks directly kind of to that royalty worldview that you're speaking about that's then reflected in this piece here.
Yeah, it really does. And what we like to talk about, just so we can contrast a minute for the living systems worldview, is you do need a boss, but it's not a person. And all of the other three worldviews, which is still embedded in this neural leadership worldview, is that comes from a person, as you just said. But you do need that focusing aspect. You need a boss. And in the living systems worldview, you make it the system. And it's hard yet for people to understand how you could do that, but it becomes external, which you're tying everyone to, and people can determine what is really needed for them to move forward. Now, there's one other thing I want to comment on here that you can tell, maybe not immediately from just the title, but all the examples that Rock gives are really basically about dumbing down to be able to match people that they're working with. So all of these studies are based on, as a machine MRI would have to be, on a brain that is at whatever level of development in mind it is right now. They assume that it is a fixed kind of idea. And Rock even says that this is based on what the brain research shows in order to make it easy for people to remember is why you're doing this. So it's not about developing people, which comes out of the living systems view, and actually even a great deal out of the human potential worldview. So it's pretty low on the levels of paradigm for research.
Got it. So as I think back to the other paradigms that we've started to kind of talk about, how do they deal with this?
That's a really good question. I was giving a couple of hints, but there's no real do this instead of doing that, because you're starting with really different assumptions and different paradigms. You assume some people are machines to have energy, or you assume all people, I guess, are like machines if you have to import energy into them, or rats if you have to manage them. But they can be developed. They can use different modalities than just the idea of tell them and accommodate to them. So the human potential movement assumes that people are pretty open-ended and that they can use their mind, whereas the studies in the MRI are really limited to what people can function and what their current potential is. If you go into the living systems view, you get a really radically different do this instead of that, but it requires a great deal of work in developing people. So what you do instead of telling people from a higher authority, dumbing it down, telling them where to go, is you develop their capacity to lift themselves up, understand the greater systems of which they're a part, design work systems so that they can move into it. So you can tell that's not a substitute one for the other.
Right. I think I see where you're going here. I've definitely experienced the difference in these assumptions in my own work and kind of seeing people work in their own work design, work structures, and the different paradigms they work through. It's like without actually reflecting using these paradigms that you're talking about, people really struggle to understand and see the work design that's around them. They kind of just assume, well, this is the water that I'm swimming in, and this is just how it's going to be. Kind of back to that satisficing idea that we talked about, like this is the best we can do for now. So it's actually being able to then use these paradigms that you're offering here. They can then see work structures that created. It's almost like they become visible to them through these different paradigms. And they help people not only be able to want to change how their work is structured and designed, but also why it's done so.
Yeah, let me give you an example of one of the things that happens if you just even pick up the human potential paradigm. So all these others assume there is one fit answer that everybody would do. It gets passed along. The human potential movement believes that people actually can image how life works. They can generate meaning out of that. So you could look at a customer and you could understand their life. You could understand why, as you said, they're doing something, and you could become discerning about what they needed. And you could even act independently without a scripted thing to remember, which is what's being proposed in this article. And then that's when innovation happens, because you don't get it from the prescriptions. And you can't even study what I just described from an MRI, because you actually can't see it. It can't be observed. And you can't really use a behavioral setting, because what you're doing is looking again at the assumption that it can't even stimulate its own thinking. It has to be incentivized from the outside. And what's continually been interesting to me is to hear David Rock, when people ask him if he's not using a behavioral paradigm, and he always says, no. But the very foundation of the study is based in a behavioral paradigm, that you have to give people something. He didn't speak about incentives and rewards in here. They have in other locations. But really, the very nature of the study itself is machine and behavioral. Now, what would you have to know in order not to have that imported information? You would have to develop people so they actually understood their customers' lives, and they understood them very well. And, you know, people say to me, how do you do that? And I said, well, you understand your spouse at home, and you don't need a program. You don't need to memorize, what am I supposed to do? This is what they like. But we can develop the mind, and we've done it in hundreds of businesses, of course, and some of other people. We aren't the only ones who've been able to figure out how to do that. But it's learning to actually understand, not through surveys, but living inside the lives of people. Apple is a genius at this. Can you see how that works if you're developing people inside of our technology, Zach? Is that responding to your question?
Yeah, I think I actually have a real world example that harkens back to my MBA days not long ago. I remember the preponderance of students that were making applications that were designed to give people more information about buying choices. So they were basically trying to outfit people with all of these applications, and all you need to know to change your buying patterns is just more information. And it turns out that in the end, while people may ask for that information, it actually doesn't change the behavior based on the new information. That's still making a bunch of paradigmatic assumptions about how people act and how they behave and all these kind of things. And we can just change their behavior if we import all this information. But at the same time, it's almost like that information, while useful, the mind wasn't ready and unable to connect that to their own buying behavior, to their own thinking, to any of these kind of things. It was like they were seeing it, but they weren't connecting it. So it's almost like reflecting, once again, using these paradigms helps people to see and helps people to grow and develop over time their own mind at work and change how they're thinking over time. I think that's the connection that I'm seeing here. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and it's the opposite of dumbing people down and doing what this article recommends, which is making it pithy, memorable, having people say it over and over again so they resource it. In fact, he suggests you try and get it stuck in their brain, just like a pop song, you know, that you're listening to. And of course, what that's doing is saying, let's make people mechanical, like machines, rather than developing them for consciousness, for the ability to image things working, discern what's important out of that, and working independently in what I call market-defined teams who really understand them. The boundaries of a developmental organization, which is what we talk about, come not from that external inputting, but from what we call corporate direction. What's the direction of the entity as a whole? And it's not delegated from the top down, but it comes from an external worldview, an external view out into the market and the market outcomes and how you're uniquely going to serve them. And then how do you get the essence of the founders to come through into what you're doing and the global imperatives which get embedded into that? Because usually what we do is we create the kind of things that we put into corporate direction in a separate department. So you get a corporate citizenship group or a social responsibility office. And the real challenge is the things I'm talking about here for research cannot be studied with an MRI. And Apple figured this out a long time ago. You know, I got to work with Apple really early when I was teaching at San Jose State University. And what I watched them do was really go into dorms, go into lives. And of course, they lived with the products themselves. And it tended to attract people, people who wanted to grow. And when you're using that method, you're bringing forward the human potential paradigm and embedding it and surrounding people with a living systems paradigm of you're in a world, there are other people out there in the world besides you.
So you said there's actually a second article on neuroscience as well, kind of positioning neuroscience as a method of research that makes us think it's giving us the gospel, quote unquote, so to speak, of truth about humans and their behavior. It's all based on the proven functioning of the brain, not even the mind, that we can study at a point in time and has a bunch of assumptions about how people are fixed and alike and all of that. So did I get that about right? That's really what the human potential movement sought to overcome in the 1960s.
Well, true.
So they must be really frustrated with all this kind of new research that's coming in.
Yeah, let me tell people the name of this article and a little bit about what's going on inside of it. It's called Managing with the Brain in Mind, and the neuroscience research was really looking at a high-performing workplace and trying to show what that would look like. And you're right, the research was from the paradigms we've already been talking about, and there are some problems out of that. The one is that they are really focusing on people problems instead of people potential in this article. So for example, the idea that people feel rejected by others in their workplace, including their bosses, was the focus of this. And it's not like we haven't ever seen that happen, that people feel rejected, feel left out. And the research itself actually looked at tricking people into thinking that they were playing an online game with a couple of other people. And then halfway through, they would cut out one person and they would continue on with the game with only two of them. And people felt rejected, like, wait a minute, why'd you cut me out? But even when they were told later that it was a controlled study, the snubbed player felt angry. They felt alienated. They felt judged. Somebody must not have liked me. The point is that they do this even when you tell them. And they felt like in this article they're proposing that you have to protect them from these kind of experiences. But it's based on the idea that people are fixed and they have no choice about their response. So that we need to manage the environment, including how leaders engage with them and all of their direct reports to foster productive change. So they recommend, and I'm not kidding, they recommend minimizing danger, maximizing a reward. Where have we heard that, Zach?
Yeah, sounds like straight out of the behavioral playbook developed by John Watson and B.F. Skinner and thousands of their students over the last, almost the last century. They kind of speak of learning not to trigger threat responses in social settings, which is another thing that I remember. I'm thinking how much my wife would love for me to learn not to trigger threat responses, and same with my kids as well. And I want the same from her and them, of course. So why is that a problem, Carol?
Well, one, it assumes people have no choice about their responses. Like, I want you to quit triggering me because I can't make another choice about how I respond. The entire field of cognitive and, of course, many other psychologies now are based on the idea that we actually have a choice about how we respond. So this message that we have to control the environment to protect them is really an anti-free will paradigm being advocated. Protect the lower people. This is like a benevolent ruler kind of idea. Take care of those people. But the second problem is that it ignored the core difference in the top and the bottom paradigms. That humans can be developed. They are very self-directed in that process. Businesses like Microsoft are often offering programs of this nature and never noticing the conflict in paradigms. So the article points out that neuroleadership ideas go beyond the behavioral idea of carrot and stick and even beyond empathy and counseling, and that they're developing instead an accommodation practice, which comes from the machine worldview. So they've fallen out of the behavioral worldview back into the machine worldview, where we have to accommodate the machine because it can't change itself. And it has to have all these energies put into it, like gasoline, it has to be repaired from the outside. So this is beyond behavioral, but not in the usual meaning of the word. It's kind of regressive to an older paradigm of humans as machines, which are controlled with hardwired brain, which we accommodate to, like the computer we use. There's one other thing here that's really important out of this article. Rock recommends using what he calls a scarf model, S-C-A-R-F, like a scarf you wrap around your neck. He had this as something he was using before most of the brain research he now uses was around. And so it feels a little to me like the scarf model has been form-fitted back into the neural leadership idea. But let's look at the model, and it's based on an acronym. So S in the acronym stands for status. It's basically a problem with stress hormones, which are programmed into us like animals. I would agree with that. You know, no argument there. But here the model refers to behavioral and machine assumptions that they cannot be managed. We have no choice, and that we will be reactive. And so we have to accommodate to those and create an environment where stress is reduced. And then, you know, people are more comfortable. Now, we already have had for 5 decades research from the National Institute of Mental Health by Paul McLean showing that this is not true, that there are 3 aspects to a human brain nested one inside of the other, each being more powerful, and the lower ones being an older evolutionary part of the brain. So they're often called things like the reptilian brain, the mammalian brain, and then the human brain. And of course, humans share those other brains as well. The stress response comes from this oldest reptilian part of the brain. And they named it reptile based on how it responds. If you look at a reptile, you know, it eats its young, for one thing. It likes laying on a rock in the sun, and it runs away at even the slightest little threat. But what McLean proved, it's McLean, that the highest brain can manage this brain. What you have to do, though, is develop the capacity for it to be more discerning and to notice and to manage its emotions and its adrenaline. And that with not a lot of effort, you could change the perception of what's going on and personally self-manage a threat that was going on around you. I mean, in fact, isn't this the basis of what a lot of training is that goes on in corporation? This is what I meant about kind of mixing paradigms, where you're here trying to protect people down here at the reptilian brain level. And yet in some other places in the organization, you're teaching them how it is to develop the capacity of individuals to self-manage while you're teaching the rest of the organization to accommodate to these lower brain functions.
So it sounds like this idea also seems to assume that really what's important here is that we need to internally manage these threats. But that does not build the capacity of all organizational members to be self-managing in regard to external business stressors, like customer demand, volatility, exchange rates, and competitor threats. It seems like you would be better off not actually accommodating these lower brain's limitations, like these reptilian brain limitations, when it is not self-managed, and instead trying to help people develop the capacity to learn the skills of self-observing and self-managing of their own reactivity and ego challenges that kind of show up around these external stressors. Then you can handle pretty much anything. Is that kind of what I'm hearing you say?
Absolutely. Because in life, the world is full of those kind of things. You just pointed out, like out there in the external world. Well, if you can't learn to do that, then you can't probably live a very meaningful and healthy life. Let's go to the second and the only one of the other letters we're going to look at today out of the scarf, the C. And it stands for craving certainty, you know, two C's. So this, again, works as though it's an internal problem and the organization needs to make the workplace safe by providing levels of certainty to calm this stress factor. Again, you could probably figure out this comes from the reptilian brain. So one begins to suspect that the designers of such processes may have had a hard childhood or upbringing or some bad work experiences and decided to make the world safe for themselves and other human beings. I hear people ever so often, you know, talk about creating a safe workplace. And I think, no, create a workplace where people have capability so that they don't feel unsafe. I mean, there are things we need to create safety around, but how people respond to one another, which are just stimulating stress for them, is not one of it. So the suggestion here in this C idea is you lead the organization by sharing more info that's been developed by management. So that's at the top of the organization again, such as business plans, you know, rationale for why we make decisions, and maybe even things like, do you know how the organization structure works and who the reporting relationships are, and therefore pathways that you could have clear communications to give more specifics of when you're going to do restructuring and to be more transparent about the decisions so that people would feel more trusting of where they go. Now, I think it's pretty obvious all of these are assumed top-down. That's like the machine, right? There's a determination that the organization will make everyone feel safe. But it's really interesting on the C one, just in case that's not enough, there's one more machine world idea. They suggest breaking everything down that you need to communicate to them that's complex into smaller increments so that they can feel certainty about what you meant. Now, living systems in most system theory got past that a long time ago and realized the world is complex. It's dynamic. It's changing. You better not keep breaking things down. But they're suggesting it that you do all of this to accommodate the fears, the threats, rather than build the capability to work in this complex, dynamic, volatile world, which is obviously core to flexible, resilient organizations and being able to recreate themselves while they're running fast down a road. This is why the upper two paradigms give what is needed for the world and industries of today. And I think what's needed for humans to be self-regulating and to be able to engage as fully functioning citizens in their communities and nations, and maybe even be extraordinary members of the families they live in and the society they live in.
So I think what I'm hearing you say here, Carol, is that I really need to remind us all that we have to discern the worldview in a flow of how research takes place. We have to question the initial exploration and review of places to start. It sounds like this leads the researcher to selecting a question within the scientific method, maybe without even realizing or just assuming that's the best way to do it. But the question here really is, how does that worldview affect that choosing? And then we design the study from there, from that unexamined worldview. They carry out the design, perhaps from the worldview it was designed, but likely layer with more than one worldview, kind of like what we've talked about earlier with mixing the machine and behavioral and kind of moving back and forth. And then ultimately that affects what's kind of quote unquote discovered. So they interpret those discoveries into findings that are not neutrally refined, but instead shoved through a mind with particular boundaries pre-drawn by this kind of unexamined worldview. And you end up with interpretations just as the neuroleadership people have. Does that sound about right?
Yep, that's exactly my point. So you can't say this research is scientific and therefore it's truth because you have to go all the way back, like I did working on my doctorate, to find out what's going on in the mind of the researcher because it is influencing everything along the way. So these questions about how do we examine what we're being offered means we have to understand this whole system and we have to go back and try and find, and I know this is incredibly demanding, but we're hoping we'll give you an example here of a methodology that you could use to kind of reveal the system and what's behind it. Not necessarily to try and copy it, but to connect people to what it means to really rigorously examine what's going on in the mind of people who are telling you something is a best practice or that it's a research method which you could study. And to encourage you to move higher up in these paradigms where you're really looking at how it is that we study a place or a being and find the meaning and articulate it in its own words. I don't believe that any of the studies that the brain people are doing right now are transferable. And there's no interpretations that find meaning for everything. And I think you can read them and you can get inspiration from them. So I'm not saying don't ever read any of this stuff, but you need to process it for the self-discovery of any system you're looking at. And people always say, well, make it your own. Well, nope, because usually you haven't even questioned what the underpinnings were. And so you don't make it your own. You just kind of move it around a little and don't customize it for you. I'm saying don't try and customize. Go back and start with questioning. Then we're really likely to actually have a methodology that's closer to us being studying something and understanding for ourselves, not dependent on experts and thought leaders. So the regenerative paradigm that I'm talking about here, based on living systems, is life-centered. It's not just human-centered. It's not just brain-centered. It's certainly not machine metaphor-centered. It's based on understanding how a whole, a singularly defined whole, can be understood, not as isolated elements one at a time that can then somehow hopefully be aggregated to understand it. But a living systems view really examines it as a living system alive and at work. And it is a particular kind of mind that it takes to do it, and it has to be done one at a time. Anything else that you do is likely to be fragmented and degrade life, just like cutting up a frog we talked about to understand it. There's no truth to be found in any way about understanding. You may have some knowledge and can name parts, but you won't understand it working if you're not engaging in this kind of examination. So please examine all research and all science to see what paradigm it's using. And even examine your own mind about how you're listening, interpreting what you're hearing. And do you see what paradigm is driving the actions that you take?
Thank you for another enlightening conversation, Carol.
You're welcome.
Remember, call and tell us about your organization and business practices on our Google Voice line and leave us a message if you have questions for us, questions for the show, or topics that you'd like to discuss. You can call us at 650-265-1193 or 6502-HUMAN. What worldview is your organization relying on? Any aspirations that are different? Again, feel free to leave us a question or a topic that you'd like us to tackle on an upcoming podcast. We also want to thank Numi T, one of the courageous ones that continues to question and examine themselves and their ways of working. Through authenticity, creativity, and commitment to people and planet, Numi T brings you the purest, best-tasting organic tea. Carol, what do you think about their tea?
Well, I love their tea. I mean, as I said several times, I was drinking this tea when I first learned about it. So I am so honored that they agree, and Rebel, because we consume their products. And we feel very honored that they agree to sponsor what we're doing.
Don't forget to pick your favorite and check out their website. And you can find that link for Numi Tea in our show notes. Also, you can download the show notes at businesssecondopinion.com. And for more on worldviews, Carol also has a video talk that she recorded that she did at the University of Washington on worldviews that are also included in the show notes. This has been Business Second Opinion.